Hello and welcome back to our study of the Book of Proverbs. One of the Bible's wisdom books, the five wisdom books, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. And we now find ourselves at the very last chapter, chapter 31. And I think, as I mentioned last time, there are three chapters in Proverbs that present difficulty. The book itself is a little mysterious, and that's in keeping with it being a wisdom book, one of the five wisdom books of the Old Testament, in which there is a lot of allegory and a lot of metaphor and a lot of hyperbole. There's quite a bit to interpret as we go through these chapters. And three chapters stand out, as I say, as being perhaps the most interpretive. Chapter 8, which is probably the most controversial, it is agreed among conservative scholars that this chapter can give us a portal into the gospel. Not many agree with that, but traditionally that has been the view of chapter 8. Chapter 30, which we did last time, is a difficult chapter in the sense that it is so interpretive and it uses such metaphor and word picture, even more than most of the book, that very few people understand it, and even most authorities have difficulty explaining it. See the last podcast for a rather lengthy study of that chapter, chapter 30. And now we are at chapter 31, and chapter 31 presents difficulty in the sense that the bulk of the chapter, verses 10 through 31, have historically in the modern church, the modern evangelical church, this portion has been maligned by many in the church. It's been disrespected, maligned, and misunderstood. I'll go so far as to say misunderstood. And so let us dive in and see where it takes us. So chapter 31. The words of King Lemuel, the oracle which his mother taught him. What, O my son, and what, O son of my womb, and what, O son of my vows? Let's stop there. So Lemuel, King Lemuel, so a king. And Lemuel is traditionally, and the Jews continue today to believe, but traditionally the church has accepted this as a pet name for Solomon that Bathsheba, his mother, would use. There are debates on that point, but That is the traditional and majority view, I think, at this point, among Bible believers, not just Bible critics, of course. Notice also in this verse 1, it says the oracle. And didn't we see this before? Yes, we did, in the last chapter, chapter 30. Chapter 30, verse 1, the words of Agor, the son of Jekah, the oracle. In other words, the words, which are an oracle. And then 31, the words, the oracle. And the oracle here, the word oracle, has the meaning of message. In fact, the NLT renders it message. The King James renders it prophecy. The Hebrew word, the root of it, the root of the word, the you know the origin is the idea of carry, and so that the word, as it's used and in the context of its use, means burden. And we would modernize that by saying pronouncement, vision, declaration. And so both in 30 and 31, we have the beginning of these chapters being characterized by this is a message, this is a burden, this is something that needs to be said. And of course the implication is a burden from God. And you do see that in much of the Old Testament. Isaiah and Jeremiah and places. For example, there are places in Isaiah where we have chapters 21, 22, and 23 of Isaiah where we have the oracle or the burden concerning Edom and concerning Egypt and concerning Moab. In other words, Isaiah says, I have to get this off my chest. This is something I've been stirred up, stirred on by God to say, and here it is. So, that's what we have in the beginning. And his mother, it says in verse 1. So, what we have in the traditional view, and it's the one I will take, is Bathsheba has been allowed to add some things to this book, but really, that's not... The better way to say it is that she said these things to Solomon, and Solomon now has incorporated them into the book of Proverbs as being delivered to him by his mother, but now he's delivering them to the reader. And this is why it says in verse 2, O my son. Well, Solomon's not talking to his son. Bathsheba is talking to her son. O my son, O son, O son. Three times in verse 2. And it should stand out that this phrase, son, or O son, or my son, has been used by Solomon himself in previous chapters. More so in the early part of the book, but still some even continuing through the middle of the book. And in those cases, they were techniques, they were tools with which Solomon presents himself as a hypothetical father speaking to a hypothetical son. But here is very different. Here, this is a literal son. This is actually her son she's talking to. Look what she says. Verse 3, do not give your strength to wisdom or your ways to that which destroys kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. Let's back up. Do not give your strength to women or your ways to that which destroys kings. So she's giving Solomon advice. And she knows Solomon. Well, let's you know, suppose that she knows Solomon has trouble, which, you know, is borne out in Solomon's life. The record we have of his life, if you look in 1 Kings and elsewhere, Solomon did have some hang-ups. He had some problems. And, of course, one of them, Bathsheba says, don't give your strength to women. In other words, she's saying, you know, look out, you know, don't make your attractiveness to the opposite sex something that's going to control your life. And in fact, it did. Perhaps not to the degree that we have in Samson's case, but in Solomon's case, it is said, back in the record, 1 Kings, I believe, that he had 1,000 women at his disposal. Some of them wives, some of them concubines. But can you imagine? 1,000 essentially wives. It's mind-boggling. And it does say in the record that this was not pleasing to God, and that the outcome of it was that these women, most of whom, the record tells us, were not of the faith, they were not in the family of God, they were not in the covenant, turned his heart away. That's the actual phrase used in the Old Testament, that they turned his heart away. We spent some time looking at that when we were studying Ecclesiastes, so you may want to go back and review the introduction to the book of Ecclesiastes and learn more about Solomon. But let's continue. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, or for rulers to desire strong drink. Let's go on. Lest they drink and forget what is decreed, and pervert the rights of the all the afflicted. Let's stop there. Verses 4 and 5. This is a good principle, and it's one that many churches use. You know, they don't just use this passage, but there are other passages as well that cause them to have a policy. And I know of one denomination in particular that requires of its leaders to not ever drink alcohol. And whatever you might think of that, that is just the case, that some churches have that policy. Not all, not even most, but there are a couple denominations that have very strong views on this subject. But getting back to the text, Bathsheba is saying, as a leader, you need to be very, very careful how you are influenced in making your decisions. Look what she says. Lest they drink and forget what is decreed, verse 5, and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to him whose life is bitter. Let him drink and forget his poverty, and remember his trouble no more. Now wait a minute. Is Bathsheba, verses 6 and 7, is Bathsheba advocating drunkenness? Is she saying if your life is lousy enough, it's okay for you to be drunken? That's not what she's saying. Remember, she's speaking to Solomon. And she's saying, Solomon, your commission, you have a commission as a leader. You have a commission as a king. And that commission is to help people whose lives are bitter. And instead of you drinking, help those whose lives are so bitter that they're drinking. Do you see? There's the flow of that thought. There's the connection. That's how it's put together. Instead of getting drunk, help those who are drunk. So she's telling him he has a commission. Verse 8, open your mouth for the dumb, for the rights of all the unfortunate. Open your mouth, judge righteously, and defend the rights of the afflicted and needy. Now this should echo with you, because we have seen in all the studying we've done of the book of Proverbs that this is a continuous theme throughout the book. Solomon really tells us many times, over and over, that a leader's responsibility is not to grind people under his thumb. It's not to step over people. It's not to, you know, take away the power and the rights and the and all of that from the people under him, but to actually look out for them, and especially those who cannot help themselves, the lowly, the needy, the destitute, the disenfranchised. That's a continuing theme in the book of Proverbs, and one that I especially appreciate. So there's the opening to the book, verses 1 through 9, and now from verse 10 on, the book completely changes. It's completely different. And it could almost be another chapter. And let's see how it starts. Verse 10. An excellent wife who can find, for her worth is far above jewels. Now it's thought, and I used to think, that Bathsheba here, again being quoted by Solomon, is saying to her son, you know, I want you to have a good wife. I want you to... which is pretty ironic, since I don't know how with 1,000 wives he could make much of a distinction between good and bad. But she's potentially saying, okay, Solomon, I'm going to tell you about finding a good wife. You would expect a mother to want her son to make a good marriage. You can expect that. Especially, you know, there being royalty. Okay? And I used to think that's the way this thing was flowing from verse 10 on, but I don't think that anymore. I don't think that anymore. In fact, verse 10 is pivotal, not only in the sense of the text really changing in its subject, but it's pivotal another way. Let's look at it again. Verse 10, an excellent wife who can find, for her worth is far above jewels. Now, different versions render excellent wife different ways. A woman of strength, a virtuous woman. You know, there's many, many ways that that has been, spelled out. But I want you to focus not on that for right now, but on the next phrase. Who can find? Who can find? That is really an interesting phrase. We're going to come back to that in just a little bit. But it means more than you think. And here's what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that the rest of the verses are describing a person searching for a wife. That's not what it means. And I think it's unfortunate that that's kind of the position that the evangelical church has taken. That Bathsheba / Solomon is launching into a treatise on how to find a wife. I don't think so. I don't think so. But as I say, we'll get back to that. I want to reference a couple of verses elsewhere in the in the book, and that would be in chapters 18 and in chapter 19. And we have interesting corollaries to our the text before us. So 18, verse 22. He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. Very much like verse 10 of Proverbs 31. An excellent wife, who can find, for her worth is far above jewels. So in one sense, we can say that who can find is echoing what Solomon has said before, that a good wife, a wife period, pretty much, is a God thing. It's a God gift. You didn't do it yourself. You were given it. And let's look at another passage that kind of says that. Chapter 19, verse 14. House and wealth are an inheritance from fathers, but a prudent wife is from the Lord. So again, we would do well to interpret this first verse, especially the who can find part, as saying, it's a God thing. It's supernatural. It is not the result of your effort in looking for a wife. Okay? Well, let's go ahead and read the text. And this text, of course, has been controversial over the years, but let's read it and then we'll exposit. Verse 11, the heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him evil, good and not evil all the days of her life. She looks for wool and flax and works with her hands in delight. She is like merchant ships, she brings her food from afar. She rises also while it is still night and gives food to her household and portions to her maidens. She considers a field and buys it. From her earnings she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength and makes her arms strong. She senses that her gain is good, her lamp does not go out at night. She stretches out her hands to the distaff, and her hands grasp the spindle. She extends her hands to the poor, and she stretches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. She makes coverings for herself, her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them and supplies belts to the tradesmen. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she smiles at the future. She opens her mouth in wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and bless her, her husband also, and he praises her, saying, many daughters have done nobly, but you excel them all. Charm is deceitful, and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. give her the product of her hands, and let her works praise her in the gates. This has been a source of anxiety, a source of frustration for many women, and particularly wives, in the church. Because they see this as a list of impossible attributes. And I mean impossible in the sense that as you read this, this is almost all superlatives. You know, things that are really over the top. I wouldn't call them hyperbole necessarily, but they're things that are really, in many ways, unattainable by the average woman. They're just, you know. In fact, there's some Jewish tradition, which I don't really think has a lot of relevance to our study, but there is some Jewish tradition that says that Solomon was sort of revisiting a Jewish tradition that he was describing Sarah and some of the other notable Jewish matrons of their day, that he was describing them, that he was extolling them, that he was lauding them. And maybe there's something to that, but I don't really think that's where the lesson in this text lies. I do think, however, the key to these verses from 10 through 31 lies in the very beginning and the very end. Let's look at it again. An excellent wife, who can find? Who can find? The phrase, who can find, it actually has, in the word find, the meaning of the word is attain, achieve. And the root of that word, in its origin, is occur, exist, happen. Isn't that interesting? It's not saying that he's located a wife. It's not saying he has discovered a wife. It's saying it happened to him. A wife happened. A wife appeared. Again, emphasizing the fact that the wife is a gift of God. And I think in the context, as it says, her worth is far above jewels, you take that whole verse together and meditate on it, you get the idea that Solomon is saying this: you don't deserve your wife. Now, this begins to color this text a little differently, in that we now get the idea that Solomon isn't talking about a man who's searching for a wife, which is what the evangelical church has assumed for all these many, many years. Solomon isn't talking about a man who's looking for a wife. He's talking about a man who has a wife already. Look at all the tenses of the verbs here. The heart of her husband trusts her. She does him good. She looks for wool. She is like merchant ships. She rises also. She considers a field. She girds herself. She senses. She stretches. She extends. These are all present tense. And yes, it could still be present tense and, be allegory for the future. There's room for that. But I don't think, given the beginning, and as we'll see in a minute, the end of this passage, I think it's all a context. It's all a unity. It's all a whole. Let's look at the end. Verse 31, give her the product of her hands, and let her works praise her in the gates. In other words, give her due. give her her due, in the sense of recognize her value and tell her the things that she does that you appreciate. That's what Solomon is saying. Well, if that's so, if the beginning of this passage tells us this is a supernatural occurrence of a wife, and the wife is already the wife, she's not the future wife, and the end of the section is Solomon exhorting the husband to recognize the good in his wife and tell her about it, that changes the whole text. It does. It changes the whole thing. Let's look at some other clues. You may not know this, but verses 10 through 31 are very special in a textual sense. And that is, if you subtract, you take 31 and subtract 10 and add 1, you get the number of verses. And guess how many verses there are? There are 22 verses. And it's not coincidental, because there are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. And so what we have here is an acrostic. And an acrostic is not an unusual thing in Scripture. There are quite a few instances of acrostics in the Old Testament. Many of them, actually probably most of them, occurring in the Psalms. There are many in the Psalms. But there's one here as well. And there were three reasons, I believe, that the ancients used acrostics. Many Psalms, the whole book of Lamentations, Psalm 119, which is kind of the famous one, but there are many acrostics. And an acrostic is, there are different kinds, but an acrostic is a passage whose verses follow the Hebrew alphabet. We're talking about Hebrew acrostic, so they follow the Hebrew alphabet, which is Aleph, Bet, Gimel. Those are the three first letters, Aleph, Bet, Gimel. And that's how this actually goes. Each line, line 10, line 11, line 12, verse 13, verse 14, each one begins with a successive letter of the Hebrew alphabet. But there were three reasons that I think the Jews and the ancients used acrostics. One of those reasons was for memorization purposes. And, you know, didactic teaching. And that's true of several psalms, Psalm 9, Psalm 34, Psalm 37, Psalm 112, and I believe this proverb. I believe it's done acrostically as a memory aid. Another reason acrostics were used in ancient writings is for the sake of beauty. Poetry, prosaic, you know, prose. And we find that in Lamentations, as I mentioned, but also in Psalm 25 and Psalm 145. And then a third reason for the use of acrostics, the goal of using an acrostic in ancient writings, was to communicate totality, you know, emphasis, completeness, exhaustiveness of the subject. It's like today, if we found a cookbook and it said cooking from A to Z, well, we would right away get the impression that this author of that cookbook is intending to cover all the to them anyway, all of the things that could be said about cooking. Well, that's exactly what an acrostic does. An acrostic, in many cases, maybe not all. And by the way, none of these three are exclusive to each other. You can have any one, or you can have two or three together in the same text. But again, the third one is this idea of completeness. And that's really how Psalm 119 works. It also may have a memorization aspect to it, although it's very long. But I think more than that, it has the idea of completeness, you know, comprehensiveness. So what we have here in verses 10 through 31, is we have Solomon, as many of the ancients did, making a beautiful and easily memorizable, easy to memorize passage on a subject he wants to get across. Okay? So why am I saying that? Why am I pointing out that it's an acrostic? Well, there's a reason. Because I think that unlike what the evangelical church has believed for so long or has taught, and to the injury and to the frustration of many women and many wives, this is not directed toward the woman. Verses 10 through 31 are directed toward the husband. They're directed toward the man, not the woman. Look at the beginning. Verse 10, he's admonished to value his wife. Look at the end, verses 31 and some of 28 and 29. He's admonished to praise his wife. That is the target. That is the reader. That is the end user of this passage, so to speak. It's the husband, not the wife. Well, let's back up to verse 10. And I skipped over something, and I want to come back to it, and that is that phrase, excellent wife. It's rendered, you know, woman of valor, it's rendered woman of excellence, it's rendered woman of strength. The literal Hebrew is woman of strength. That's actually the literal translation of the Hebrew. But it doesn't mean that the word is limited to that very technical rendering. Not at all. Not at all. In fact, in Israel today, I am told, this Hebrew phrase, which is Eshet Halel, this phrase, Eshet Halel, is actually used every day in modern usage. For example, when someone is about to graduate college, or if a woman becomes pregnant, or a woman is engaged, or an individual has landed a new job. If it's a woman, they would say Eshet Halel. If it was a man, again, who landed a good job, who succeeded in business, who maybe got engaged, they would say Gibor Halel. Eshet Halel or Gibor Halel. And all that means, if we were to render it in modern vernacular, in modern English, it means good on you. Congratulations. You see? Way to go, girl or guy, right? So if we bring this into the modern wording, verse 10, an excellent wife, it's saying a wife that you can be proud of. It's saying a find. A wife who's a find. And that is very significant. It's interesting that we find this phrase used again in the book of Ruth. And you remember the story. Boaz and Ruth, and of course Naomi, her mother. You find, or mother-in-law, you find that Boaz says this to Ruth. When it first becomes apparent that she is making herself available to him to marry, he says, "You are an Eshet Halel. You are an Eshet Halel." She wasn't married yet. She wasn't a mother yet. She hadn't made any clothes like the Proverbs 31 woman. She hadn't bought things from afar or dabbled in commerce. Or engaged, I should say, not dabbled, engaged in commerce. And her home wasn't in homes and gardens. You get this? He's saying, you're a find. You are a find. And the same thing happens here. Solomon starts out by saying, this is what the husband should say to his wife. You are a find. And he ends the section, the passage, by saying, give her her due. And it says products of her hands. In other words, Think of the things she does and tell them back to her. Now, this should color your understanding of this passage. All right? So let's look over it again briefly. Verse 10, an excellent wife who can find her worth is far above jewels. He's saying, you don't deserve her. You didn't really get your own wife. She came from God, and you do not deserve her. It's a gift. She's a gift. Verse 11, the heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. He's saying, regard your wife as an equal partner. Regard her as an equal partner. Verse 12, she does him good and not evil all the days of her life. Remember that she, from the very beginning, the wife is to be the aid of the husband. That's what the commonly used phrase help meet or help suitable in Genesis is all about. The Hebrew actually in Genesis is aid. You could render it in English aid. Regard her as your aid. Remember, she's your aid. Verse 13. She looks for wool and flax and works her hands in delight. This is a woman, this is a wife, who labors to maintain the household. She works to keep the house together. 14. She's like merchant ships, and she brings her food from afar. She's diligent about always having food there. You know, a lot of women, a lot of wives, regard grocery shopping as kind of a chore, kind of a pain. And really, maybe their husbands ought to praise them for that diligence. Verse 15, she rises also while it is still night and gives food to her household and portions to her maidens. Now, this is pretty interpretive, but I've rendered it, she washes the dog. She washes the dog. In other words, she's proactive to do those things that are mundane, that are kind of behind the scenes. Nobody really notices, but they're part of making the household operate. They're necessary, but they're sort of undesirable things to do. Okay? They're behind the scenes and they're mundane, but she does them. 16. She considers a field and buys it. From her earnings, she plants a vineyard. She is wise with the household finances. She's wise with the household finances. She knows what to do with the money. 17, she girds herself with strength and makes her arms strong. And 18, she senses that her gain is good. Her lamp does not go out at night. This is pretty plain. She's not lazy. She's not lazy. 19, she stretches out her hands to the distaff and her hands grasp the spindle. She understands the importance, and this is kind of connected to verse 16, but verse 19, she understands money. She understands the how to handle money in the household, its importance, and how to use it. Verse 20, she extends her hands to the poor and stretches out her hands to the needy. I love this passage. I love this verse. So 19 says she understands money, but 20 says she does not worship it. She's willing to give it to people in need. Do you understand? 21, she's not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. Her preparations include the seasons. You know, doing the things around the home if there's a family business or if there's, you know, anything else that she would be engaged in, she knows the things that are specific to different seasons. And she does those. You know, if they were on a farm, you know, that would be very plain that would be different in different seasons or whatever. She does those things. Verse 22, she makes coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. She doesn't neglect her appearance. She doesn't neglect her appearance. Verse 23, her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She supports her husband in his ministry. If he's sitting in the gates of the land, he's actually involved in the administration of the city. And that's his ministry. And you could extend that into New Testament ethos by saying that she helps him in whatever ministry inside or outside the church, which, you know, could be different things. She supports him in that. And verses 24 and 26, she makes linen garments and sells them, supplies belts to the tradesmen, opens her mouth in wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her lips. She has her own ministry in addition to that. In addition to supporting her husband, she has her own. And there's an interesting thing there in verse 24. The marginal note says that the word tradesman, in the New American Standard at least, is actually the word for Canaanite. So what she's doing, and this is why I like to call it her ministry, she's actually interacting with people outside the Jewish culture. You know, the New Testament, you know, version of that would be witnessing to your neighbors, making sure that you are not hiding your light, making sure that you are, that you have a ministry to people outside the family of God. Verse 25, strength and dignity are clothing. And she smiles at the future. And we can combine 27 with that. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. So she stays busy. And this keeps her from fretting. This keeps her from being discontent or spending time in gossip. And then verse 28, her children rise up and bless her, her husband also, and he praises her. Her family values her. And not the least of that you know, part of that is they tell her so. Her family values her, and they tell her so. Well, these are pretty neat things, and I don't know how helpful it would be to know this, but you could group all these things into three categories. Three categories. Number one, she looks out for her family. Clothing, groceries, early rising, family affirms her. Okay? Number two, she protects her husband's reputation. It's actually a part of her. You know, because your spouse has a lot to do with how you are regarded in the community. Or, New Testament rendering would be in the church. Your spouse is an important part of who your family is and how they're regarded. So she protects her husband's reputation. Number two, she's known to be wise, her character is visible, and she's the crown of her husband. And number three, the third category, she's an equal partner in the marriage. She's his aide. She contributes to the financial security. You know, there is a verse that Solomon gave us that tells us the opposite. A woman who does not build up the family, who does not build up the household. Over in chapter 14, verse 1, the wise woman builds her house, but the foolish tears it down with her own hands. Okay, so what can we say about this? What's the takeaway here? Well, the target is the husband. It's not the wife. This is not a passage, 10 through 31, this is not a passage that is an exhortation to the wife to earn praise. On the contrary, it's an exhortation to the husband to give praise, not to earn it on the wife's part, but to give it on the husband's part. This is the reason for all the superlatives. This is the reason that 10 through 31 reads over the top, like, you know, Superwoman, you know, Wonder Woman. This is the reason. Because the husband needs that encouragement. He needs that, dude, look for the good in your wife and say it. So 10 through 31 is not about unattainable things. It's about unsurpassed things that actually exist. They're unsurpassable. And they're things you need to tell your wife. This is a love song. It's a love song to your wife. And I believe the fact that it's an acrostic, the fact that it's done in an acrostic is because it's a script. It's a script for the husbands. Not a cheat sheet. I mean a script and not a script, not a checklist. It's not a checklist for the wife. It's a script for the husband. It is said that Jewish women, conservative Jewish men, I'm sorry, Jewish husbands, actually recite this to their wives every Shabbat. And particularly when they have daughters, they have the daughters present so they can hear it also. Isn't that amazing? So the bottom line here with 10 through 31 is this is not a prescription. This is not a formula for how to be the best wife. This is a description. It is a profile of an already existing wife whose husband needs to tell her these things. This is not a benchmark. This is a blessing. This is not a condemnation, as many hold it to be today, but an affirmation. And again, it's not about earning praise, it's about giving praise. And this Eshet Hillel, it's not look for a good wife, it's look for the good in your wife. Let me say it again. This passage is not about looking for a good wife. This passage is about looking for the good in your wife. So, Eshet Hillel, I got a good one. That's what he's saying. I got a good one. Not I'm looking for one. I got one. Okay, men. Take heart. And that brings us to the end of Proverbs. I think what we'll do next time is I would like to hit on some of the high points, not belabor it too much, not really have a full-blown review, but just sort of point out some highlights. I don't know if we'll do that or not. Anyway, stay tuned and we'll carry on. In the meantime, believe God.